that people have come up with to write inventory. And I've tried some of them. I've done the autobiography. I attempted once a some 172,000 question thing from somewhere and couldn't do it. I'd gone over all that and over all that and over all that for 12 years. And all I know about that is if anybody here can find an inventory other than this way that has a set of promises attached to it that will absolutely happen if you write inventory that way, every time you write inventory that way, for anybody you ever see, write inventory that way, I would love to try it. I'm open to that. But I haven't found an inventory with a set of promises that will absolutely happen when you do that other than this one in the short time that I've been sober. So, based on that and the experience I've had each time writing inventory this way, I continue to do it this way. I've tried some different things with the basic format. But I think what it talks about here on the bottom of page 63 is that this decision that we just considered at the third step on the top of 64 is a vital and crucial step, but it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in myself which have been blocking me. That was very important for me, that statement, because I thought once again I was going to have to go into the middle of all that stuff that I had just spent 12 years going through and work on it or cope with it or deal with it. And I remember my sponsor saying to me that there's two basic ways to go into inventory, frames of mind. And one is if you told a little kid to go clean his room and he thinks all he can do is move stuff around and rearrange it, that would be a terrible job and he wouldn't want to do it. But if you told the same little kid, you get to go down to your room and you get to throw everything out that you don't want anymore for all new stuff, he would go into that same room and he would be overjoyed. That would be a wonderful experience for him. And then I should try to take that frame of mind into my inventory because it tells me exactly what inventory is. And it is an effort, and it sometimes is strenuous. And the first one was very strenuous. And it is a strenuous effort to face and be rid of. It doesn't say a strenuous effort to face and cope with the things we're having trouble with. It doesn't say face and deal with the things we're having trouble with and how we feel. It doesn't say face the patterns of your life so you can be more in touch with how you feel so you can work on it. It says a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us from God, from myself, and from other people. An effort to face truth. A man said to me one time, and it made really good sense, that if you're seeking truth, you're seeking God, because God is truth. And I don't know, I made that decision, and I did the prayer, and I got up off my knees, and we talked a little bit, and he started reading this to me about the inventory, and he gets to the bottom of the 64, and it talks about resentment being the number one offender, and that it destroys more alcoholics than anything. Now, that's an interesting statement, that resentment destroys more alcoholics than anything else, even alcohol. Because from resentment stems all forms of spiritual disease. We are not only bodily and mentally ill, we are spiritually sick. And that's what we've covered all the way up to this point. The physical part, the mental part, the spiritual part. Now we're going to get down to the cause and the condition of my alcoholism. I think one of the things to be aware of, because they use it on the next page in the example of the three-column inventory, is not to confuse the second column as the cause of your alcoholism, because they call it the cause. It just happens to be, and you later find out that isn't even true, the cause of the resentment that you think of at the time. But I think in the middle of the fourth column, which we'll get to in a couple pages, which is not in the example, but it says should be put down in black and white, the root or the cause, and in the third column, which they do give us an example, the condition of each area of my life and where these resentments have taken me. It was an interesting idea to me that resentment is a spiritual malady. I always thought resentment was an emotional problem or a mental problem because I feel it and I think about it. But to realize that a resentment is a spiritual malady that shuts me off from this power that I so desperately need was an interesting idea, which I found to be true in writing. And it's just, he gave me one instruction at a time. And it's still the way I like to do it, because to try to do all four columns with a name that comes takes me into four different frames of mind. So he gave me one instruction at a time. And it said, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, and principles with whom we were angry. And I was instructed to go home, and I started using the third step prayer in the morning and at night. And I came up with a little prayer to help me with inventory. Please help me face and be rid of the things that are blocking me from you. And each time I would sit, I would try to get centered. And I literally started to experience another type of prayer. And I literally started to experience the list, my resentment list, my first column, coming from a place other than my head. I thought I was going to have to go back through my life and think up everybody that I was ever mad at or resentful of. And as I started practicing what I had done at the third step of going to a quiet place within and saying my third step prayer, I started to notice a prayer that was coming from here. And it would scare me a little bit, and I would play with it once in a while, and I would say a few words of the third step prayer, and then I would think a few words, and then I would get quiet, and I would go to that place, and I would hear the words coming from here. And I started to experience a type of prayer that I had never experienced before. And Don told me that I could begin to use that practice of getting centered and going to that place to watch for the difference between when my list was coming from that place or when it was coming from my head. And for a period of time, I think when you start inventory and you're working on this first column, I think it's a good time to carry a little pocket-size notebook. And I would carry this little spiral notebook, and if I was at work or in the car or having a meal or somewhere out of the house and a name would come, I'd put it in my little notebook and I would take it home and I would put it on my list. And sometimes I would start with my earliest memory and I would just get centered and go to that place, and names that I hadn't thought of in a long time would come. And sometimes I would start with today and go back to my earliest memory. And I think people are simple. I believe in going with what comes, not to question it. We'll do that in the next column. I believe if a name comes, you think of it as a gift and just put it down. Don't think, well, how do I still feel? I don't feel that way about him anymore. I'm over that. Why did this name come? I believe if you're centered and you're in prayer and the name comes, put it on your list. And I think my first list was probably 300. I've seen people with less. I've seen people with a lot more. It's interesting to me that the more introverted people, I had a librarian once, and she does her life in her head. Humongous list. I mean, she would think herself above murder, but all she's done all her life is literally kill people here, just shut them out of her life. And they tend to think that the extroverted person who does it all out here is way beneath them, and they would never do anything like that, but they just do it all up here. They tend to get the big lists because their life has been in their head. And us guys that do all the extroverted stuff and punch you in the face and it's all right out here and boom, have the shorter lists with probably more harm. That's questionable too, though. And we think we're way above the passive little wimps that don't do much. And it's a funny thing to listen to when you're hearing footsteps. The passive thinkers thinking they're way above the aggressive doers, and the aggressive doers thinking they're way above the passive thinkers. I believe just trust what comes. Institutions were a little complicated for me, and I just started some names. You know, there were drug programs that I'd been in, and alcohol programs, and parole, and probation, and some institutions were groups of people. Mexicans, and Polacks, and black people, and smart people, and dumb people, and beautiful people, and ignorant people, and bigots, and racist. Landlords and bill collectors. The institution of marriage. principles I was even more confused about because I didn't get here with very many. And Don explained to me that principles were values and beliefs that I was raised with that I at some time resented, and values and beliefs that we're told in AA we need to live by to stay sober, which I think are really interesting. Now, I find that the longer people are around, the less people they have on their list and the more principles. And it's also interesting to me that every principle I've ever resented, if I look at the opposite of it and I'm honest with myself, I've also resented the opposite of it at some time. Love, you know, when it starts to choke you or confine you or make you feel like you're suffocating, or hate, or truth or lies, or honesty and dishonesty and selfishness and unselfishness. All kinds of stuff came. And I just listed them and I kept asking him, how will I know when I'm done? And as I said, in going through this every year since that first one, my inventories get shorter and my amends list gets smaller. This last inventory that was about 40 pages took, I sat down three times for 2 hours and it was done. The last two before that, I spent a little time each day for 5 days, so I'm not going back through that old stuff that I've gotten free of. There's new stuff that comes from the past. There's new stuff that comes from people I've written about before because I'm still involved with them. They're still in my life. But I kept asking him, how will I know when the list is done? And he just kept saying, you'll know when the list is done when you know the list is done. And one day I sat with it a few more times and nothing more came. And then there's really only one instruction for the second column, and that is to ask yourself why you were angry. And this is where I enjoy it. If I had this big list, let's say I have a list scattered on several pages, and then you don't need to worry about saving space or room or institutions in one column and principles and people in another. Just let it flow, and you'll know when it's done. I was told to take the first name off my list and put it on the left-hand side of a piece of paper and number it, and then just go next to it and letter them. When she did this, and when she did that, and when they didn't do this, and when they didn't do that, and just let that second column flow. I never saw this until not too long ago, but Bill actually gives us two ways to do the second column in his example. I happen to like the first one with Mr. Brown, because he does each resentment one at a time. Pays attention to my wife, told my wife about my mistress, and might get my job at the office. So he's looking at three separate resentments. In the next example with Mrs. Jones, he kind of lumps them all together in one paragraph. She's a nut. She snubbed me. She committed her husband for drinking. He's my friend. She's a gossip. And he just does one third column. I tend to like the first one, where I take one resentment at a time. He was 57 years old when I was born. I think what helps me with the second column, especially with the things I do with the third column now that are somewhat intense, I try to be specific without dragging it out. I don't need to put, when I was walking down the street on the 2nd of May in 1979, he came up to me on the corner of Hill and 2nd and punched me in the face. I just need to put down he punched me in the face, but I don't also want to be too general like he's a liar. I want to put what he lied to me about that made me mad. So I just let that flow. Some you only have one. Maybe all he ever did was steal $500 from you. Some, like the major people in your life, there could be A, B, C, D, there could be 20 or 30, like with mom or dad or sisters and brothers. I also believe in letting the second column just come. And I believe you can start to experience, if you're practicing going to a quiet place within, you can begin to experience when you're thinking it up and when it's coming to you. As two different experiences. And I tend to, when I'm back in my head and I'm trying to think up, I mean, if it's there, it's there. I tend to feel it more flowing when they're coming to me. And I like to do all the second column for everybody, so I'm not changing my reference of thinking. So I like to do the second column for everybody. And that's where I get to bitch. That's where I get to take your inventory. That's where I get to continue to believe the lie. That's where I get to stay in the lie. That the reason for my resentment was because of what you did. But it's such a tricky process that it takes me to what I think is true and turns it into a lie, and what I think is a lie that I have any part in it, turns into the truth. and what I thought was the truth turns into a lie. I'll give you an example from one not too long ago. 2 years ago, I was engaged to be married, and she left me. And for a couple days, that was the truth. And if you would have seen me and you would have asked me, you know, why are you hurting? Why are you in pain? Why are you upset? I would have told you what I thought was the truth. I would have said, I'm hurting because she left me. That's the truth, isn't it? That is the truth. That's the truth. That's the truth that I'm willing to die for. That's the truth that I'm willing to hold on to. That's the truth that I want to hold on to. That's my perception. So for a couple days, I go around to meetings and I just milk the heck out of it, right? Oh, she left me, right? A friend of mine comes up to me and says, why don't you go home and write inventory about her leaving you? So I go home and I do what I was taught to do, and I put her name. We have a different way of saying it in our group, but I won't. Well, I put her name in the left-hand column of a piece of paper. And I put in the next column of the piece of paper, I put left me. Then I'm asked to examine 6 or 7 different areas of self that were either hurt, threatened, or interfered with when she left me. And it says in most cases I'll find that it's either self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, sex relations. Then in the next paragraph it's kind of confusing because they repeat themselves. They repeat self-esteem, then they add one, number 6, security. Then they repeat ambition, personal relations, and sex relations again, which is kind of a confusing paragraph. But then way at the bottom in the example with his wife, they add one, number 7, that they haven't mentioned, which is pride. So I'm looking at 7 different areas of self. Self-esteem, ambition, pocketbook, personal relations, sex relations, security, and pride. And I go through those and I ask myself, when she left me, or like when Mr. Brown paid attention to my wife, Bill found that his sex relations and his self-esteem were hurt. I go through there and I find that when she left me, it affected my self-esteem, which is how I feel about me. It affected my pride, which is how others feel about me. Definitely made me look bad, right? My ambition, which is what I want, affected that. My security, which is what I think I need, affected that. Personal relations, definitely. Sex relations, definitely. Pocketbook, maybe not. And I found 6 out of 7. So I put those 6 down in the third column of a piece of paper. I'd like to talk just a little bit about that because in the last 6 years, I've been doing something different with that changed my entire experience with inventory and myself and other people. And when I'm angry, thinking that you're doing it to me, it just changed a lot. And it came from some men and women that have been doing this work for a long time. And I guess in continuing to read this book and continuing to do the way Bill wrote it out here in 3 columns, even though there's another part that he mentions in a little while here, they started asking themselves with the bottom of 65 where it says, we went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. They started asking themselves, what does it mean when these 3 columns are done to consider it carefully? And they started asking themselves, he also, if you notice in the example, he also, whenever he does the third column, when any one of those 7 areas are hurt, threatened, or interfered with, he also mentions, if there's fear involved, mark it. And that gets a little redundant because what you find is any time one of those 7 areas is hurt, threatened, or interfered with, there's fear. That gets a little redundant. But I guess that's what they wanted me to see, that whenever any of those areas, which are the major areas, which are almost every area of my life that I can think of, whenever one of those areas is hurt, threatened, or interfered with, there's always fear. So I found I was just marking fear by every third column. But in asking themselves, what did they mean when they said, when we were finished, we considered it carefully? They started to ask themselves, because the way I used to do it was I would read it to you, I was mad at so-and-so for leaving me, it affected my self-esteem, pride, ambition, security, personal relations, sex, and I would read those words to you, but there was never any connection to it. And after about 2 of those inventories, a friend of mine asked me once, he said, with all you've seen in the fourth column, which is looking at my part, selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid, with all you've seen in the fourth column as far as your part in either bringing it on or while it was going on or after it happened, your part, your stuff, what you did, in all you've seen in that, in these 2 inventories, if we took an example right now, and he took the example of so-and-so leaving me and that affecting my self-esteem, he said, why do you think your self-esteem was hurt? And I said, because she left me. And that's the trap that he wanted me to fall into. Because he said, oh, so you're blaming your troubles with self-esteem on the person in the first column and what they did in the second column. And what I was literally telling him, that my problem with self-esteem when she left me was because she left me. Then once again, my troubles are not of my own making. My problem with her leaving me, as far as it affecting my self-esteem, were her fault. He said, what if you found a part of yourself that causes you to become angry when she left you with what you think is the truth, which is what I think is the truth as to why I'm angry? What if he said, what if you found that a part of you that causes you to become angry was hurt when she left you because it tells you that no one should leave you no matter what you do, and you're really the king of the hill, and that it's not low self-esteem, and that your self-esteem was not hurt because of her leaving you. Your self-esteem was hurt because of this belief system you have when you get angry. And I started to examine the third column from an ego belief system. And my ego wants to put down, because I felt worthless, no good, rotten, piece of you-know-what, or undeserving and she should have left me, or what I thought I was no good and deserved to be left anyway. And with that, I never get to anything concrete, because what I think and how I feel is constantly changing. One minute I'm a rotten, no good son of a gun. The next minute I'm, my thinking is never really concrete. It's always changing. And we started to examine what the ego tells me that causes me to become angry. Because if you're at peace and somebody walks in the room and says, you know, Joe, you're full of you know what. Now, if I'm at peace and I'm in a fit spiritual condition, I'm going to handle that one way or the other. I'm going to ask them, why are you saying that? It's not going to matter, because I either know I am or I'm not. We're going to talk about it. We're going to do something healthy, right? But see, when so-and-so walks in the room and tells me I'm full of you-know-what and I get angry, it's because there's a part of me in conflict. And the part of me in conflict is the part that says, you know, nobody should really talk to you that way. You're such a fine, upstanding guy, and you're really quite a hell of a guy that no one should really talk to you that way. And that's why I get angry. So what comes off the end of my pen for the third column is, when she left me and it affected my self-esteem, it always has to do with what my ego tells me I am. I am. What does my ego tell me I am? I am someone that no woman should leave, no matter what I do. Don't think of this is what I'm examining truth. This is where I'm examining the lies that my ego tells me. And my pride, how you see me, no one should see me being rejected by anyone. My ambition is what I want. I want her to stay no matter what I do. Security, then you're up against the biggest lie of all, because you're in direct conflict with your ego, the stuff it tells you you need to exist. And the biggest lie of all comes off the end of my pen. I need her to stay to be okay. You know that stuff in the middle of the night your ego tells you you literally need to exist? It's never God. If I don't get that job, if I lose that money, if I don't get her back, you won't exist any longer. And personal relations, no friend should do that. Sex relations, women are meant to be left, not leave. Women leave. Men leave women. Women don't leave men. And all these screwed up beliefs that I have that my ego tells me. Now, I was not able to do that the first time. What I was able to do the first time was to write the two columns and put which areas of self were hurt, threatened, or interfered with. And we talked about that in the fifth step. I do not share that with people that are doing inventory their first time. We talk about that in the inventory, in the fifth step. But for the last several years, I have been able to examine that, and I have seen that when I can really see what I'm up against that causes me to become angry, I no longer think that it was her leaving me that affected my self-esteem. And once again, I get to get free, because my troubles with her leaving me and it affecting my self-esteem were not of her making. It was because of this belief system I have when I get angry. Then it tells me it gives me some things I should be convinced of, that my life, when it includes deep resentment, leads only to futility and unhappiness, and what happens when I permit these resentments. Then it asks me to do two different exercises in looking back over what I've written. One is kind of if I'm to be free of this anger, I turn back to what I've written, and I try to look at it from another angle. And I try to take a kindly and tolerant view, and I try to see this as a sick person like myself. How can I be helpful? They give me a prayer. Some people do that for every resentment before they move into the fourth column. I tend to do this little prayerful exercise whenever I get to the fourth column and I can't see anything. I'm stuck. I try to do this little prayerful exercise. So they take me through that. Then they take me to going back to what I've written once again, putting out of my mind what they did. I resolutely look for my own mistakes, and I write out, where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and my fears. And I find that I find those in the third column. My dishonesty, there's three types of dishonesty in my experience. There's the outright lies. I lied to her about this, I lied to her about that, I lied to her about this, with explanations. I don't go along with the little check, fourth column checklist thing, because it gives me nothing for my fifth step and it gives me nothing to be clear on to make my amends. I think my book says that it says where, not were we, selfish, dishonest. It says where was I selfish? So I write explanations. As far as the dishonesty, I look at outright lies. I look at the lies of omission that I used to think weren't as bad as the things that I literally lied to you about. What do you mean, honey, I was having an affair. I never told you. I didn't lie to you about it. I just never told you. That's just as dishonest as telling a lie. So I look at those two types of dishonesty, and then I look at the self-dishonesty, the delusion. I thought I was so special, she should never leave me. I thought that I needed her to be okay. I look at three types of dishonesty. As far as honesty, I think the best, from these inventories that I've written, the best definition of honesty for an alcoholic that I've ever heard is that I will do what I say I'll do. I mean, I will say what I will do, and I will do what I say I'm going to do. Because when I look at these inventories and where I cause harm, I've either not told them what I was going to do, or I have not done what I said I was going to do. So I think the best working definition for me has been that I will say to you what I am going to do, and I will do what I say I'm going to do. That works for me. So I'm exploring selfishness. It's what I wanted. I wanted her to stay. I only cared about how I felt. I only care about what I wanted. Things that I did that were selfish. And self-seeking, the things I was after. Some people ask the difference between selfish and self-seeking. I don't tend to try to figure out exactly where they belong under those two, but the best one I've ever heard is selfish is the stuff that I want to hold on to and not let anybody have, and the self-seeking are the things that I'm after that you have. But nowadays, I just try to get to, based on this resentment, what did I do? What did I do? Did I shun her? Did I scream at her? Did I punch her? Did I shut her out of my life? Did I, you know, what did I try to get? What was I after? Then my dishonesty. And then I get to look at my fears. And I find my fears all the way through the third column and all the way through the first part of the fourth column that I've written. And they just come out real simple fears with no explanation. Looking bad, not getting what I want, rejection, pain, being alone. And then I'm going to examine those in the next inventory. I do three separate inventories: resentment, fear, and sex. Before I ask someone to write the fourth column, we go back to that statement on page 62. Our troubles are basically of our own making, and I ask them that before they start the fourth column, because see, the fourth column can be one of two experiences. You can go into it with your ego and beat yourself up for what a rotten, terrible person you are, which is just ego, or you can go into it to get free, to discover the truth about the lie and find out that she didn't leave me, that I drove her away, that my selfishness and my dishonesty and my self-seeking and my fear literally drove her away, and the first two columns turn into a lie. And the third column, I've really seen the lies. And the fourth column turns into the truth, which I thought I had no part in. I thought my truth a few days ago was that she left me, and that's why I was upset. And I find that selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking, dishonesty, and fear, and these beliefs I have about myself and how you should see me, and what I want, and what I think I need, were what drove her away. And I can either get free on that, or I can make it into a grueling exercise of self-pity and destruction. So what I ask people to do before they start the fourth column is to go back to that statement, our troubles are of our own making, and find the positive side to it before they start writing the fourth column. The negative side is, gee, look at what a rotten, terrible person I am. The positive side is, thank God this problem with her was of my own making, because she doesn't have to change, do a thing, come back, see the light, or anything for me to get free. It was my stuff. And if this stuff can be healed, she doesn't have to. I mean, if everyone in the first column of an inventory needs to do something for you to feel better and get free, you're really in trouble, if your troubles are not of your own making. And it's an amazing thing for me to be able to say to you that from my first inventory, that big inventory, I couldn't find one resentment in my entire life where I didn't play a part. So you always get the standard question. How do you take the blame, or how do you see your part when you were 5, 6, 7 years old with all these terrible things that happened to some of us? Well, you can't. But you can see what you did with it for the next 30 or 40 years. It's literally held you back from a lot of people. Now, mine, I didn't have abuse or any of that stuff. But I had a resentment toward a father who was 57 years old to my earliest memory. So back to my earliest memory, I was able to see how I was playing God before, way before I ever took a drink. I thought I knew how old he should have been, what he should have been doing with me, how he should have been, and how selfish that was. And got to get free. And he'd been dead for 9 years. And all I did was follow through 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 at his grave. Did the ninth step at his grave and got free of a lot of blame and and I've heard a lot of inventories and I've written several since. I've yet to find one where somebody can come up with a resentment we can't find some of their part in this fourth column. But it's not to take and beat myself up with. It's to take and get free. It's for me to be able to be taken to a place where I can say, thank God. Thank God I had a part in this. Because I can get free now if this can be healed. They don't have to do a thing. She didn't have to come back. She didn't have to beg for my forgiveness. She didn't have to change. And I got free. They talk about looking at the word fear marked by the third column for each resentment. And what this thing, this stuff, this fear does, touches about every aspect of my life. And if I've written out the third column, I see where fear permeates those 7 major areas of my life. Then they make an interesting statement about fear that I never understood. They say, didn't we ourselves set the ball rolling? We think fear ought to be classed with stealing. Now, I don't think they were writing this book for kleptomaniacs. I think they were writing this book for alcoholics. And for me, stealing is a conscious decision. A friend of mine says to me one time, is it possible that fear is a conscious decision? We'll come back to that in a minute. But what it tells me to do in the next paragraph is to review my fears thoroughly, and I find my fear list from my fourth column. I now use my third column to find those fears too, but I just want to look back through my resentment inventory, and I want to start to make a list of general fears and not repeat themselves. You're going to find rejection in almost every one of them, or pain, or feeling bad, or looking bad. I don't want to list those over and over. I just want to begin to make a general list of fears. I've never really found anybody with more than 100. There's only so many fears. And they're all through my resentment inventory. Some of them I had no resentment in connection with. So when I was done with that list and I'd gone through the whole resentment inventory, I said a prayer and I asked God to show me any fears that didn't make my resentment inventory, and a few more came out. Heights, snakes, bugs. And I started to work with this general list of fears. I was told to go back through it and cross off any repeats. You don't need to put rejection from mommy, rejection from daddy, rejection from my girlfriend. I'm just flat afraid of rejection. And I think my first one I had about, I don't know, I had about as many as my last one. But what you find out is that there ain't as many as you think. Because what the next instruction is with this general list of fears, however many you have, is to ask yourself why. So it kind of turns into a two-column inventory. And I don't go past finishing. I don't go past the list until I'm done with the list. I take the first name, the first fear off the list. I put it on a piece of paper and I ask myself why. Why am I really afraid of rejection? Well, if rejection felt good, I wouldn't be afraid of it. So the reason I'm really afraid of rejection is it's painful, makes me look bad, I'll be alone, and it just comes out to a real simple second column. And I do that for each of my fears. Then I was shown a very interesting thing. I was showed that what I thought, from all these fears I found through my resentment inventory, what I thought was about 50 fears, once I wrote the second column and looked back through the second column, it was really only about 10. So the fear inventory begins to turn into like a playoff chart from a tennis tournament or a basketball series, where you start with 36 teams and you end up with 4 or 5 or 6. And I looked through this second column and there's about 10 fears. I took those 10 and I wrote a second column on them, and I saw that from those 10, there was really only about 4. And I find that this big, huge mass of fear that I think I live with is really only about a couple things. And different people find their own truth in that. It usually has to do with, as far as I've been able to break it down, for me now sober, it usually has to do with relying on self or relying on God. Or pain or pleasure or failure or success. Whatever word you put on, it comes down to two basic things. Whether to die an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. Every fear inventory I've ever written comes down to those two propositions. Whatever names you put on them when you break these down. And it even says, isn't fear because self-reliance fails? And we went back to that question. Is it possible that fear is a conscious decision? And I say to myself, I have never chosen consciously to be afraid of these things on my list. I never made a conscious decision to be afraid of heights or snakes or looking bad or... They say, well, is it possible there's one decision you've made on a regular basis that sets up every fear you've ever had? And that decision that I've made on a regular basis that is a conscious decision most of the time that sets up all my fears is to rely on self. And I start to see that isn't my fear because self-reliance fails. Self-reliance doesn't solve the fear problem or any other. When self-confidence makes me cocky, fear is worse. Then it talks about some things I should be convinced of from the fear inventory and a new attitude to take. And then it talks about a sex inventory. Many of us, like myself, need an overhauling there. We try to be sensible on this matter. It's easy to get way off track. One set of voices cry that sex is just the lust of our lower nature, the base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voice who cry for sex and more sex. We want to stay out of this. We don't want to be the arbitrator of anyone's sex conduct. We want to stay out of this controversy. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. I had a friend that used to say, they tell you, what is it they tell you not to do your first year? Don't get involved for your first year, but nobody knows if that works because no one's ever not done that. The one I like is don't make any major decisions the first year, and then a couple months later they're asking you to decide to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. No big decision there, right? Yeah. Or don't make any judgments, but stick with the winners, right? That's confusing. So as far as the instructions for the sex inventory, one says that we reviewed our conduct over the years. Now, I was told two different things about that. I was told, first of all, to make a list of relationships. I was told this inventory is not about sex, per se. It is about motives in my relationships. There were one-night stands and people that I couldn't remember. But I tried to go back through my life, and I'm making another list. By the time you get through with the 8th step, you will be so tired of making lists. But you begin to trust that you know when those lists are done. And I would pray and I would get centered and names would start to come. I don't know how many I had my first one. If I said it, I'm sure it would be over-exaggerated anyway. And I had a lot less this last time. And that's not because I've become a modicum of health. Several times I was told to make a list and answer these 9 questions, and I would just do them in paragraph form. And there's 9 questions with explanations. Where was I selfish? 1. Dishonest? 2. Inconsiderate? 3. Who did I hurt? I was told to look around the relationship too, not just her. Her kids, her boyfriend, her mom, her dad, her sister, her husband. Where did I arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where was I at fault? Kind of some stuff to sum everything up I had seen so far. And the one that you don't want to do unless you want to change. And if you don't want to change in this area of your life, don't answer. And that is, what should you have done instead? And that's the only warning throughout all these inventory instructions. And moving through my first inventory, my sponsor said, don't answer this 9th question unless you want to change in this area. And I wrote that out and began to form an ideal for the future. And it says that in this way, by answering these questions, we're trying to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. It says that it is a chosen ideal. It says that it is an ideal that I should ask God to help me mold. Thank God it doesn't say, what could I have done better? I couldn't have done anything better at the time with what I had. There's a lot I should have done better. And the other instruction that I've heard interpreted a different way with the first line is, we reviewed our conduct over the years past, and that means to write specific sex conduct with each name that you have on your list and then answer those 9 questions. So I now do both. I make the list and I trust what comes. I write a brief history about that relationship, my motives for getting involved, the specific conduct that went on, whatever comes, where it is now or how it ended. And then I answer the 9 questions. But I basically try to stick to that paragraph. And sometimes I've done it in 9 columns. Sometimes I've done it in paragraph form. But I try to stick to those basic 9 questions. And I usually try to mark in some way question number 9. And then when I'm through all of them, come back to what should I have done instead, to use as a guide for choosing my ideal for the future, based on what I saw I should have done with each of those. Sometimes it was as simple as this. What should I have done instead? I shouldn't have gotten involved with them in the first place, right? Sometimes there was things I should have been more honest. I should have been more open and considerate of what she wanted, her feelings. And from that, I can use that as a guide to write out, and I do write out, because I love to see what happens with this. And it's the only part of the inventory that I keep after the 8th step is done. I love to see what comes from the ideal that I have chosen each time. It doesn't mean the ideal woman. It's not my picture of an ideal woman. It is the ideals that I would like to bring into my future sex life of what I would like to be. I would like to be more kind. I would like to be more considerate and open and honest, etc., etc. I guess the only other thing that I've ever done any different, or that I've ever been asked to do once all 3 inventories were done and the sex ideal was written, was, and sometimes you find that after all this stuff is out and down in black and white, it's like layers of stuff. One layer comes out and there's another layer there. It's interesting how the book breaks down the inventory, because it starts with what we think we're mad at, and it takes us to what really caused the anger in the first place. It's like peeling away an onion. And then you find that behind every one of those resentments, not only was it your part in it, but there was fear involved. And then they say, well, now let's look at fear. And then you get through fear and you find out that's the stuff that motivated every relationship. And then they say, now let's get to this core, this base instinct stuff. And it's literally like peeling away an onion. And the only other thing that's interesting, sometimes it's never there until the inventory is done, are any secrets or stuff that I thought I'd take to my grave, or anything that I'm consciously aware of that's not in the inventory that I need to admit. And there were some of those the first time, and since then there's been some. Sometimes I usually can get to it in my writing. I believe if inventory is written without an intent, that I'm writing inventory to discover the truth of what's blocking me from this power that I need, I believe inventory turns into a terrible thing. I believe if you're using inventory to solve problems, all you end up with is a new line of bull. That the middle steps are not to be used to solve problems. 4 through 9. 4 through 9 are to face and be rid of the things that are blocking me, so I can be closer to this power. I've tried to write inventory to solve problems, and all I ended up with was a whole new belief system, whether it worked or it didn't. I also believe if you make this decision at the third step with any kind of sincerity at all, and don't start inventory, or start a little piece of inventory and then stop, you might as well have not done started at all, because you will literally watch the inventory go on in your life without you, just because you're not putting it down in black and white. I believe there's a part of us engaged in the inventory process, whether we're putting it down on paper, and if we don't finish it, or if we start it and stop, you literally watch the inventory happen in your life, and all you see is resentment and dishonesty and selfishness and fear. I have seen people stop in the middle of inventory and become physically ill, seriously ill, drink. That's why I think it's so crucial around the third step, or even to give yourself the dignity at the very beginning, to really decide, is this what you want to do, and decide into that, and then maybe reaffirm that before you take the third step. I would rather see someone not even begin inventory or make any kind of a third step decision than to get partway through it and stop. My first time, I got tired of doing little bits of it at a time and finally took 3 weekends and stayed home and finished the fourth column and got through resentment and started to balk. And it was only a couple weeks, and almost got arrested for some gambling that I had done earlier in my sobriety. And I went to Don and I said, I'm in the middle of this fear inventory that I refuse to finish, and I'm going to get arrested for gambling. He said, what a great thing to happen in the middle of a fear inventory that you won't finish, because you'll either do one of two things. You'll either run or you'll finish it. And it moved me back to finish my fear inventory. And then I stopped again partway through my sex inventory. And two women called me the same day that I had, one I had been involved with earlier a few months and one I was currently involved with. And they were both pregnant. And I called Don and I said, I'm in the middle of this sex inventory and I haven't written for a few weeks, and two women that I've gotten pregnant called me. Said, what a great thing to happen in the middle of a sex inventory that you won't finish. He said, you'll either run or you'll finish. And that moved me through this. But it's not necessarily a great time around the house either. That's why I don't play with inventory anymore. The last three inventories, I have set the day that I was going to... I would take the third step, I would get to inventory, and I would decide when this is going to be done. The last two were done in 5 days. The last one was 6 hours, over three different days. I don't like to stay in inventory. It tells me exactly what to do when that inventory is done. And it tells me why. The best reason first. Many who have skipped this step have drank, trying to keep to themselves certain facts about them, their lives. They've sought out either easier methods. It once again, like inventory, tells me why I am going to fifth step. To get a new relationship with my Creator and discover the obstacles in my path. I like from about, it seems like from four on, they tell me why each step I'm doing it. Not time to read all this, but it talks about picking the right person. It talks about a closed mouth, understanding friend. It talks about, this is a little off, but it talks about the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. And because of the interest I've had in some of the people I know that do this work, back a few years ago, there's a man in Chicago named Paul Martin, and a lot of people around this country fly up there and go through the first three steps with his group and then go home and write inventory, and you come back and over a weekend they'll put you up in a motel and they'll send eight or nine strangers by your motel and you read your fifth step to them one at a time, from newcomers to Paul. I didn't go and do that, but I wanted some people in Los Angeles to know me on that level. And not this last fifth step I read to one man. The two before that, one I read to five people, one at a time, two of my best friends and three people that I had worked with. I've read one to a woman, which was an amazing experience, and the other four or five or six before that were to one man. And that came from a day of waking up and being trapped by the ego And my ego said, there's only one man in this country you can go read this inventory to, and that's Don P. in Denver. And the next thought was, if you believe that, you're dead. And if you don't let some other people know you on this level, it's going to kill you, because what happens if Don is gone? And that was at about 5 years sober. And that year, Red My Fist up to two men that I had worked with at one time. I've had times where writing inventory, I want to lock it up in a safe in my room, and I would no way think of letting anybody see this. No one should find it. It's locked in my briefcase, in the car, in the trunk. No one's going to get to this inventory. And I finish writing, and I take it to somebody, and I read it. And the next day, there's not one thing in there that I couldn't say to anybody in the whole world. And you get free. I've never come out of a fist step feeling bad. I've never come out of a fist step not feeling free. Talks about when we decide who's going to hear this, we waste no time. We have a written inventory. We're prepared for a long time. We're prepared for a long talk. We explain to the person what we are about to do and why we have to do it, and he should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. If you would have said to me that a year ago, that I would one day fist step with an American Indian man on top of a 13,000 foot peak overlooking Pikes Peak in Colorado Springs, Colorado, I would have said you were crazy. There's no way I was open to anything like that. If you would have said to me 4 years ago, you're going to fist step with somebody other than Don P., I would have said you're crazy. I can't do that. And every time I wanted to get free, the same voices that are out in the meeting where I talk about wanting to get free aren't the voices out in the meeting. They're the conflict within me. And there's always the voice that says, you can't do that. And there's always those of you and the voice within that says, go for it. You really want to get free? I think every conflict that I experience outside of me is some kind of experience that it's some kind of conflict that I'm experiencing outside of me. I've yet to experience any conflict that wasn't something that was going on inside of me. When there was people at the meeting when I said I wanted to go to my dad's grave and make amends, and they said you can't make amends to someone who's dead, and the other part of the room said, go for it, son. You can go to his grave and you can do what you were told to do. That wasn't a conflict in the meeting. That was my own conflict. And when I thought there's no way you can go to the top of this mountain with an American Indian man and sit and read a fist up, that wasn't because there was people telling me I couldn't do that. That was because there's a part of me that believes what it believes, that doesn't want me free, that wants me confined with prejudice, culture, old ideas. Old ideas aren't that bad anymore. It's the new old ideas. The worst ones are the ideas based in virtue. I used to have this black and white mind that thought anything negative is all negative and anything positive is all positive. For example, self-will is all bad, and helping others is only good. And it was a one-sided mind, and I couldn't see the duality of things. And in writing inventory, I wondered why the seventh step talks about the good and the bad. And I wrote in some inventories, some stuff about self-will that did a lot of good. What do you think newcomers are really attracted to here? If we were all saints, do you think they see our holiness or our spirituality or how great we are, or do they see themselves? And I saw, even though I don't like when self-will causes harm, a lot of my self-will has done a lot of good. And working with others and trying to be helpful has sometimes kept me from looking at myself, and it's been able to be used to keep from doing that, and that there can be negative in that. And that within every negative, there's positive, and within every positive, there's negative. And started to see things with a different mind. So you come to this place of admission to someone else. And of course it should be of your own choosing, someone that you trust. But it's a powerful place to come to admit truth. It's not like anything I ever did in therapy. It's not like anything I ever did in group, because my intent is different. My sponsor I've had all these years, and the man I just did a fifth step with in June, they have both, and the other people that I've done this with, they have always made me feel honored that I would trust them on that level. And they have always helped me feel that we're involved in a spiritual activity with myself and them and God present, and that this stuff was about admitting truth, to seek that power, not to analyze, not to figure out, so we can work on it. I had a young man not too long ago with quite a bit of sobriety, and we did a lot of work together, and he put a lot of time into inventory, and he came over to my house, and we started to read this inventory. And you, when you've done this for a while and you've watched fifth steps rather than just doing your own, you've heard other people's, you watch for something to happen. And what you watch for is you watch for them to begin to crack, and the ego begin to crack. And as he was reading, it was clear as a bell. What he had written was clear, and it was starting to happen, and I was watching it happen. And once in a while, he would want to stop me and move out of it by saying, "Do you want to help me see anything with that?" I'd say, "No, it's clear. Keep reading." A little while later, he'd say, "Do you want to help me see anything with this one?" What he wanted to do was he wanted information so he could go fix it. He didn't want to experience the experience. He wanted more knowledge about it. And I'd say no, but if he wasn't clear, we would talk about it. But it was clear as a bell. And the first day we weren't done yet, and he went home and he came back the next day, and I said, "Describe what last night was like." And he said, "It was like I was experiencing my own death." And I said, "Great, that's what inventory is, that's what the fifth step is about. To experience the death of an old being that you want to get rid of. That's what six and seven are all about." We started the next day, and he would read, and it would begin to happen. I could feel it. He'd say, "You want to help me see anything with this one?" "No." "How about this one?" "No." And I told him when we were done that what he wanted during that fifth step to keep away from seeing truth was information so he could go work on it, and that I wasn't going to do that for him. And I really thought something happened, because when he was asked this question at the end of the fifth step, "Have you withheld anything?" See, there's some more promises that can come true here. He said, "I haven't withheld a thing." Broke down a little bit, and there was some type of surrender. And I'm told to go home and find a place where I can be quiet. Take the book down. Carefully review what I've done. Some people think this is the beginning of the sixth step. I think it's the end of the fifth step. It doesn't really matter. But it talks about reviewing what you've done. It talks about stones, and it talks about cement. And if you haven't been thorough up to this point, you don't know that at the second step where you were willing to believe, they called that the cornerstone. And you don't know that at the third step, when you made this decision, they called it the keystone of this arch they start to talk about. And you don't know that on page 17, they told you the two parts of the cement that bind us, the common peril and the common solution. And if you were to go home and just do this part from the book, and you got to, "Are the stones properly in place? Have you tried to make cement without sand? Have you tried to skimp on the mortar?" You wouldn't know what these analogies are about, but it's about reviewing what you've covered so far, and this cornerstone of willingness, and this keystone of this third step decision, and this idea that we suffer from not only a common problem, but we have a common solution as a cement to this arch. And it goes through that. And then I believe between page 75 and page 76, there's a major shift. And I believe the shift is they now ask you to begin to trust this power. It's actually one of the promises back on 75 that you might have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now you begin to have a spiritual experience. And I think there's a shift from 75 to 76, where up to this point, they've told you can't trust your own mind. Look what you do with your thinking. Now they ask you to start to trust that. To start to trust that you've been given something to move through this work that you've done, that there really is something there. Because they say, after doing that review, when you've answered to your own satisfaction, Trust that and look at these six-step questions. They say that willingness, once again, is indispensable. And they raise a question. Are you now ready to let God remove from you all the things that you have admitted are objectionable? To consider that. They raise another question. Can He now take them all, every one? We add one from the ABCs and from the 12 and 12, along with can He would be will He for me. I've never gotten through 5 and looked at 6 and had a problem with can He, because I've seen it in your lives. But I've always had to consider a little bit with, faced with all this stuff, with mud on my face, with all this stuff I've just admitted in step 5, will He for me? And then it tells me what to do if I still cling to something I'm not willing to let go of. I ask God to help me be willing. And then it asks me to trust again. And when ready, to do the 7-step prayer. That I've always done alone. And that has always been really personal and very powerful. And I don't mess around between for very long. As I said earlier today, I do not list defects and ask my sponsor what order I'm going to work on them and presume that I can work on them. I've tried that before, and it turns into one of those carnival things where you pop this one down and this one comes up, and then you pop that one down and this one comes up. I think 6 and 7 are about God working. I think 6 and 7 are not a place to stop for very long, although there might be for some of us serious considerations between returning home and the 6-step questions and being ready. I had an idea at one time that being ready meant I'd answered yes to all those questions and that I had to be a good boy to go to step 7. I found out one time ago, not this time, but the time before, that when ready means where I am, and that there was a few things I wasn't willing to let go of, and I didn't answer yes to all those questions, and I moved on anyway, and I did the 7-step prayer, and I didn't have to be a good boy to go to God, and took it on that basis. And I think you know when you've done 6 and 7, when you got a piece of paper and you're doing an 8-step list. And I find that 8-step list from my inventory. It says we made it when we took inventory. And I work on that list until I've gotten every name of every person and every institution that's in that inventory. And I put them on a piece of paper. And then I say a prayer. And now I've had experience with these lists. And I say a prayer. And I ask for anything else that I've ever harmed that wasn't maybe in my resentment inventory. And I get some more. I don't think financial amends are the most important. I don't think any of them. You know which amends I think is the most important? The next one. I mean, there's people I owed money that I didn't harm close to what I did to my family and some of my friends. And some of them, I find out when I go to them, some of the ones I thought were big deals, they didn't even remember who I was. And some of them I thought I hadn't really hurt at all. I had really hurt. So I start making this list. It's interesting sometimes for those of you that have been around for a while, if you do another inventory and there's a lot of principles in that inventory, make a list of principles that you've harmed and ask yourself how you can make amends for that. I try to stick to people and institutions and money, financial stuff. And I find it in my inventory if I've been thorough. Then there's an exercise that Don gave me that I didn't think was in the book that he did in the Colorado State Penitentiary, because they couldn't get out right away when they had done this work. And that was that when my amends list was done, to go through each one and picture that person, get centered, say a prayer, picture that person face to face, and ask myself, am I willing to do whatever this person might ask to make right the wrong, and just mark it plus or minus whatever comes. And I found out later that it says here at the bottom of 76, as we look over the list, so they're asking me to look over this list, we may feel misgivings about going to some of them or diffident about going to some of them. And I don't try to change it. If it comes that I'm not willing, I put minus. I don't try to change that when it comes. So I end up with this list of everything that I'm aware of with a plus or minus by each one. And I've gone through and I've asked myself, am I willing or not to do what this person might ask? So my next question to Don was, how in the world will I ever get the willingness to do the ones I put a negative by? He said, by doing the ones you put a positive by. And I found that as I move through the amends that I'm willing to do, those minuses start to change. Then we do something in our group just to be a little more complicated. We take the names off that list and we put it on a 3x5 card. And we put their name or their address, or if you don't know where they are, the word find. And then all the harm that we're clear on that we can pull out of that inventory or that we're aware of on the rest of the card. And we do that for everybody on our list, and then we get rid of the inventory in a meaningful way to ourselves. Take it down to the beach and start a little fire and burn it and say a little prayer. I don't know. Something it's always been a meaningful way to me. And I'm left with a pile of 3x5 cards, and I put them in piles. For me, currently, it's those in California that I'm willing to do, those in California that I'm not willing to do, those in Denver that I'm willing to do, and those in Denver that I'm not willing to do. The first time, there was lots of piles. Out of state, Colorado, financial, willing to do, not willing to do. And I just started with the pile that I was willing to do, and I knew where they were. Some I had to find. Some I never found. The book tells me what to do. I think the freedom... I think there's more work in the 8th step with my sponsor than I did in the 5th. Because I go to him with these cards, or I go to him with this list, and we start to talk about how these should be done. And I say there should be a letter written. He said, you better go see him. I say, I think I need to go see him. Well, maybe a letter. And I trust, once again, I trust somebody else who's had experience with this work. And I go through those cards and we talk about the harm. We talk about how that person's going to be contacted. We talk about whether it should be face-to-face. My general rule is if they can be seen, it should be face-to-face. And I think a lot of freedom came for me. And my sponsor describes an experience in the Colorado State Penitentiary finishing the work on the 8th step, literally being lifted up and set free before they even knew that he was and let him out. I think it's a big turning point because I've done all this private, kind of with one other person work. And now the power is either there or it isn't to turn out to the world and go repair this stuff. Why don't we take a 15-minute break and come back? Thank you. I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to be down in the smoking room at a table with the smokers. I think the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th step of Alcoholics Anonymous are the most exciting things in the entire world. I think it was kind of interesting for those of you that have been here since this morning that are aware of how it can feel in a room. And I've done it where we've been closer together before, like, you know, 30 or 40 of us in a circle where we're close. And you start talking about the first step. And I could feel it here today, and I'm sure some of you did. You can literally feel it come over the room, kind of. And it gets hard. And I mean, it's just on you. It feels heavy. And you move into the second step, and you get a little energy. And I was a little tired with 4 through 8. That was probably the hardest for me to talk about, and it should have been the easiest because I've just come through, like I was sharing earlier, from June 15th to June 25th for a 10-day period in Denver, 1 through 8. And it was interesting to me in the last session, even though I was a little tired and I had just eaten lunch and everything, that 4 through 8 were not easy for me to talk about. I think that has to do with an experience that's currently going on that's new, that's hard to talk about. And I think some stuff happened with 6 and 7 that I'm right in the middle of. And in becoming willing and looking at this list of amends that I have at 10 years of sobriety, my sponsor has a sponsor, and I know he wouldn't mind me saying this because he's shared it himself from a lot of podiums, named Gary from Indianapolis, Indiana. And at 26 years, and he'd been doing this on a regular basis all those years, was experiencing some things in his life that he wasn't happy with. And he heard about this man that I talked about in Chicago and had met him, but didn't know him well, named Paul, and flew up to Chicago and went through the first three steps with this man, 48 years sober, and drove home and wrote inventory, 26 years sober, willing to submit themselves to this process. And finished that inventory and went back to Chicago and sat in a motel room and in different lengths of sobriety, sat with strangers that he'd never met and read his fifth step, and then sat with Paul and read his fifth step. It was like seven or eight people over a weekend. Then they sat with Paul and looked at the eighth step. He got in touch with some amends he'd never seen. Financial stuff. Went home, talked to his wife, sold the house, moved into a trailer to pay off these amends. And when I saw him at the end of that, he was on fire more than the 10 years that I'd known him. He was willing to do that with that much time. This woman that I talk about, Lynn, from Denver, 33 years, runs the Denver Central office. She talked to me when I was home when I was in Denver last week, about doing this work at 33 years. I remember one time when she asked me to, she asked me, could she read some inventory to me? And she was probably, 30 years sober then. I thought, oh boy, is this going to be heavy. She wants me to hear her inventory. Boy, after 30 years of writing inventory, it's probably so evolved and probably so... And she sat down and was just like mine. Petty little resentments, petty little fears. And what came over me was a profound respect for this woman, that at 33 years, she would be willing to do that. And she keeps getting free. She's probably the most exciting 68-year-old woman I've ever met in my life. She's run that office for 15 years. She loves rock and roll. She loves the symphony and the opera and is terribly involved with her family and her grandkids. Every time she does this work, it's like her life takes off to another. And every time I've done it. And you get through all this grueling work, you've done all the mechanics, and you start to experience the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous and go back to people that you thought it could never be repaired, and you get to watch healing. It's hard enough to find the instructions for inventory until someone sat down with me and showed me each specific instruction. It's even harder to find the general principles and the guiding principles for making amends in the pages between 76 and when you get to the 10th step. They're just hard to find. And I needed a man who had experience with making amends. He had done the first eight steps in the Colorado State Penitentiary, and he was released a year and a half later. Some of them he had made by letter, some phone calls he had made, but then he gets out and he has this big chunk of stuff. And he started talking to me about a general format to follow, whether it's face-to-face, which, like I said, I think the general rule is, if you can see him face-to-face. Any of the extenuating circumstances we'll talk about, and you hold yourself in readiness if you ever see them to make them again. Or ask that person, is there anything more we need to talk about since you got my letter or my phone call? That's what I try to follow with the people I work with. If they can be seen, let's go see them face to face. But I needed a format. I heard a guy one time in Brentwood, California. It's kind of a ritzy area of near Beverly Hills, and he told this horror story. It was a meeting where you spoke for 20 minutes and then you answered questions. He told this horror story, crimes worse than mine, all this stuff, hell's angels. By the time it was time for questions, the room was so scared that no one dared raise their hand. And I felt kind of sorry for the guy, and I raised my hand and I said, you know, you and I have some similar experience. Can you share with us some of your stories about amends? He said, oh, I was told except when to do so would injure them or others, I'm others, and if they're going to hurt me, I don't need to make them. I thought I was going to faint. First thing they ever told me about amends, you're not others. The book talks about not shrinking at anything. Using our mind, consulting the right people, but not shrinking at anything. We may face jail, damage to our reputation, loss of a job, family. We don't sacrifice them to save ourselves, but we must not shrink at anything. And I needed a format to go to some of these people. I had some heavy-duty stuff. Armed robberies. Guns in people's faces. I was not a nice guy who drank a little bit too much. And I'm not a Boy Scout. Some of you that have been around for a while, I bet you've seen people come to AA thinking they were bad and they came here to get good and they were trying to become Boy Scouts, die. I'm sick trying to get well. I'm not trying to get good. So I needed a basic format to go to these people. And I was given a basic 5-point format that still works for me today. And that format included in these pages, and we could pick each one of them out if we had time, as I've had to do as I've gone through this book, and they're all in here. It says that saying sorry is not enough. It will not fill the bill, and a remorseful mumbling that we're sorry will not fill the bill at all. I don't say I'm sorry. I tried that. One of the biggest mistakes I made in going through the steps, I think I was in inventory, and I had a brother near Denver that I had really harmed. So because of guilt, which is a terrible thing to go into amends, to go make amends with, because then it's just to serve yourself so you can feel better and get free of your guilt. I think forgiveness comes, and the freedom and the freeness from the guilt comes from 6, 7, and 8. You go to them free of that for the real reason to make amends that it's going to tell us about here in a minute. But I'm in the middle of this inventory and I'm experiencing some guilt, and I run down to Albuquerque, New Mexico to make amends to my brother. And I basically wanted to go through all the bad stuff I had done to him and say that I was sorry. And I did that in a half-assed way. And I said, I'm sorry. And he said, I know you are. You have been all your life. What are you going to do? I didn't know what in the world to say. I later had to go amends for trying to make amends. I do not use the word I'm sorry. So I was given a format. I was told to explain to the person why I'm there. Sometimes I say, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes I say, I'm involved in a program of recovery from alcohol. Sometimes I say, it's very important that I do this so they understand why I'm there. Nothing more confusing to an ex-girlfriend than to call her up and say you want to clear some stuff up and she thinks you're coming over to get back together. Or a boss, ex-boss, wondering, why in the world does this idiot want to come see me? I like to let them know. It says that they should understand that I'm on a life and death errand and that it's very important to me, so I tell them why I'm there. Then I tell them all the harm that I'm clear on. Then I ask them, is there anything else that I ever did that I'm not aware of that we need to talk about? And they get their chance. Hopefully, that'll be the last time they'll ever get to do that. But if I'm free and I go with an undefended heart, with a spirit of forgiveness, I can do that. Because I'm going to get free. I'm going to be fit to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. The real purpose for amends. We're trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose in making amends is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. So I explain to them why I'm there and the harm I'm clear on and ask them, is there any other? And then I ask the magic question of all. I'm sorry. I asked one before that. And before that I ask, do you need to tell me how any of that hurt you? because I am sometimes terribly insensitive, and the ones I thought I really hurt, they didn't remember. And the ones that I thought I barely hurt, I really hurt. So I asked them. And then I asked the magic question. What can I possibly do to make this right? Is there anything that you would have me do? And the man's is about change. Some of the ones that come to mind are going to my dad's grave. My biggest, strongest, longest, oldest resentment. 30 years worth. I mean, I had resentments toward him 9 years after he died. New ones. It's interesting to find out that grief for an alcoholic is 90% selfishness. Not that there isn't valid grief. But what did Bill talk about? We experience instincts to the nth degree. It was real interesting in inventory to find out 90% of my grief is, why the hell did you leave me before I was done with you? And it was all about selfishness. Except what real grief there was. A lot of it was selfishness. Fear. And I wrote a letter and I went to his grave. I went through just like we were face to face. And I felt like he was there. And I felt like he heard me. And I was supposed to leave that graveyard and I was supposed to head to the airport. And this quiet voice says, you're not going to the airport, you're taking a drive. And I had been in that town 5 times sober before these amends in Battle Creek, Michigan. And whenever I went somewhere, I was looking over my shoulder or I was hooked by different places or things or places that I had been before. They still had me. And that day, after making amends at his grave, when all my amends were done in Battle Creek, Michigan, I was literally guided to take a drive where I was born and the neighborhood I grew up in and where I drank and where I used to hang out on my way to the airport. And I was free. And the next time I was there, I walked down the main street and I didn't look over my shoulder and I wasn't worried about one person maybe seeing me. That's a day that a guy like me lives for. If you want to get free. If you want to just feel better, you could take each of those people and you could go to someone and you could sit in their room or their office and you could cry and yell and scream and talk and beat and punch and sob. And you could do all that stuff with each of those people, and you might feel better till the next time you see them or think about them. You might even get some relief, but it's always temporary. It always came back. As much work as I did on my dad in therapy, I used to love the one where they let me put his face on someone else and bang the hell out of him with one of those things, because I get involved in the anger, right? Walk out of the room feeling better. It was all just for me. It wasn't for anything else but for me to feel better. And it always went away. And it always came back. Since the day I left that graveyard, I have never experienced the feelings for him that I lived with for 30 years. Ever. That's the difference between relief and freedom. And I think to make these amends, whether consciously or unconsciously, at some level, each and every one of us, if we're ever going to do these kind of amends, have to reach a place, whether we know it or not, where we want more than to just feel better. Where we want more than just relief. I remember another one that I wanted to do right away, because it was close to Denver, so I could feel better and I didn't talk to Don about it. And I was going to run up to Aspen to make amends to one of those girls that I had gotten pregnant early in my sobriety during my first inventory. And thank God at my hotel room, I sat and said a prayer, and then I headed for her store. Aspen's not very big. Between my hotel and her store, I ran into 5 people, including her sponsor, who every one of them told me, she's not ready to see you yet. And for the first time in my life, I didn't do something so I could feel better, and didn't make it, and went back to my hotel room, and for the first time in my life, didn't do something to serve myself, and got free. And several months later, the door was open for us to see each other. And today, we're great friends. I see her all the time. She lives in California. I can't heal something like that. Therapy can't heal something like that. Can the power of God heal things in my life that I can't? There I am, back to my agnosticism once again. God is either everything or He's nothing. Where am I with that? It's a great time in the middle of balking at amends to realize and remember where you are with alcohol, where you are with step two, and reaffirm that third step decision. Because every time I have started fooling around with amends, these men and women that have been doing this work for a long time, they always ask me. They'll either ask me one of two questions. Where are you with your third step decision? And where are you with alcohol? What's the truth about you?